four-length lead, now by five, but they're coming down to the finish. Brilliantly ridden on the front end by Richard Migliori. Richard Migliori.
This is In the Room with Sean Clancy.
I'm Sean Clancy, and I'm in the room with the MIG, retired jockey Richard Migliori. The 56-year-old won 4,450 races over a stellar 30-year career, starting with an Eclipse Award as leading apprentice in 1981 and rolling through meet titles on the New York circuit, a Breeders' Cup win aboard Desert Code, stakes wins on the likes of Student Council, Friends Lake Win, Artie Schiller, Hidden Lake, and the one and only Four Star Dave. Welcome to the show, Richie.
Thanks, Sean. Yeah, when you hear those names, you know, it kind of brings me back, and certainly Four Star Dave is a horse you and I both had a lot of affection for. You got to gallop him. I got to ride him, the Sultan of Saratoga.
No, he was the best. I mean, I love the way you rode him. You would be aggressive. I mean, he's kind of your type of horse, right? Be aggressive, put him up in the race.
Well, I always believed in getting your position going forward, you know, particularly the era of riders that I came around in with, you know, I should say, you know, Angel Cordero, Jacinto Vasquez, you know, all these guys, they got their position going forward, and they fought for position, you know, guarded the inside jealously. You know, it seems a little bit different now. Maybe, you know, I'll come off sounding like the old guy back in my day, but...
we are old.
No doubt about that. And it goes by fast, too, but... you know, it was a privilege to, you know, be an apprentice with a room full of Hall of Famers like that and basically learn to ride by, you know, just watching, observing their habits, how they approach things, what they did, and certainly schooling you. You'd learn your lessons, and if you didn't learn, then you just had no aptitude for it because you were riding with the best.
Yeah, who were your idols growing up? I mean, before you started riding and then in the room, who did you really watch and try to emulate?
Well, when I was a kid, I mean, Shoemaker was an obvious, you know, he was such a, you know, mainstream guy beyond just being a jockey. He was on commercials and the Tonight Show. And I remember when I was 10, I already knew I wanted to be a jockey. Everybody, you know, kid growing up in Brooklyn wants to be a jockey. Everybody thought I had a screw loose or like, you know, that was it was a phase, I guess. But my grandfather gave me the book, The Shoe, It had all these incredible pictures of Shoemaker and you know, Santa Anita, and it just captured my imagination. And my grandfather inscribed, "I'm sure you'll do as well as him." And I, obviously, that would have been an incredible, lofty goal. But just the fact that, you know, about 5 years after my grandfather gave me that book, I'm getting the Eclipse Award by Shoemaker, which, it happened pretty quick.
Right, for sure. Yeah, very different style, though. I mean, he was little and light, and you were much taller. I mean, who did you try to emulate style-wise?
Well, you know, I used to look at Baeza a lot before I started riding because everybody talked about him being taller and angular, and that was certainly me. And then when I first started riding, Cassius Musen had won the Eclipse Award the year before me, and he was tall, and I loved the way his seat. I loved the way he... you know, folded up on a horse. There was so many angles, but that's what you had to do to manage your height. And then in the room, there were so many influences. I mean, Eddie Maple was a tremendous influence for me. We had the same valet for years. I could be mercurial. I could be, you know, I win five and I'm over the moon and get beat on a favorite and looking to fight somebody and upset. And one day he looked at me, and I was still a kid, probably 18 or something, and he said, "Okay, you got beat on a couple of favorites today," because I was mad. And he goes, "What are you going to do tomorrow morning?" And I said, "Well, I'm going to get up early. I'll be at the track. I'm getting on horses." And he goes, "Okay, what if you had won five today? What would you be doing tomorrow morning?" And I said, "Get up early, go to the track, get on horses." He goes, "So why don't you just take it in stride, just be even?" And, you know, they called him Steady Eddie for a reason. You know, dieting, I'd obsess about food. And he looked at me one day and said, "You know, food's always going to be there." And it kind of just put it in a different perspective for me. But Eddie certainly was that kind of influence in the room for me.
Yeah, knowing what you know now, what would you have done differently? I mean, would you have? I mean, we've talked about it over the years. Would you have not been? It seemed like I think you were used to press and really be. I mean, really try to show everybody. You know, I think that was part of your talent too. I mean, I think it's part of why you got where you did. But now with perspective, what would you do anything differently?
Yeah, I definitely would. I definitely tried to make things happen, particularly if I was. I won't even say slumping, just maybe struggling a little bit. I was going to create. I wasn't going to let it come to me. I was going to go make it happen. And you know, you're talking about a relationship with your horses and animal, and sometimes I would get lost with that a little bit. I got better at it the last few years of my career. And honestly, frankly, working with Godolphin and those kind of horses the last 2 years of my career, I had come full circle. Like when I was a kid, I was more of a horseman. In the middle of my career, I was more of a jockey. And then at the end of my career, last 2 years of my career, honestly, I felt like I was back to being the horseman. I'm more proud of myself, more proud of how I was approaching it, how I was doing it. Even when I had great success looking back now, you know, and obviously the benefit of hindsight and clarity, there was a point where the horse was just a vehicle to get me to the winner's circle. And I really don't look back at that with pride, even though I was having tremendous, success. I just didn't think I was respecting my relationship with the horse as much as I should have been.
And that's something you learned as you went along, I guess. I mean, that is something you kind of had to recognize and almost take a step back. And maybe you were even better when you did take that step back slightly.
Well, I'm certainly much prouder of the rider I was, you know, when I got through that period. You know, I came up under contract to Steve DeMauro, and you really did bring him out. You know, so much so that I won the Eclipse Award, and the next day I'm in the barn at 5 o'clock in the morning because I still rubbed the pony. So I had to get the pony stall done and get him tacked up. And that was, you know, back then I probably didn't appreciate that. I probably resented some of the things I had to do. And now I'm so happy that I had that experience and understanding how he taught me to be a horseman, a horse person, and not just a jockey and not take it for granted, understand the process. But like I said, then in the middle of my career, you know, here I am. I'm in the middle of my career, like 4 or 5 years into my career. I was, you know, I'm the MIG, I'm a jockey, I got to win, I won almost 300 races in 1985 at 20 years old, but that's not one of my proudest seasons, I have to be honest. Like I said, later on, I was always comfortable, Sean, riding for a stable and being a part of that stable because of my upbringing under contract and being a key member of the team. And being at the barn every morning. I excelled when I rode, you know, first call for Hushing because I was involved. First call for Kimmel, I was involved. And one day, Rick Mattee had a horse out on the track. He was Saeed Bin Sarur's assistant in the States for Godolphin. And the horse had bolted and was running off down the outside fence with the exercise rider. And he turned to me and said, I think I got to tell them to bring this horse home. He's one for one in England, but he's just uncontrollable. And I asked him to get on the horse. And I said, you know, I'd like a crack at him. He said, you want to get on that thing? Because this horse was going 90 miles an hour down the outside fence. And I said, yeah, I think I might be all right with him, you know. And I worked him a week later, and I was not on the outside fence, but I wasn't on the inside fence. I was probably in the middle somewhere. And came back, what do you think? I think, you know, let me give this another try. And was a little better. Well, the horse wound up being Afrashad, and he won the fall highweight. He won the Mosley at Suffolk, and, you know, he actually came around, and he and I got on pretty good, and that led me to getting the mount with Flashing. But the reason I brought all that up was that was the scenario I think I thrived in, that, you know, go to the barn, talk about the horses, get on them, you know, come up with little different insights, different ideas, and have a familiarity that a lot of times when you're riding a, you know, 1,000 races a year, 1,500 races a year, you just don't have the time to create that relationship.
For sure, that's the rewarding, the really rewarding part of being a jockey is when you're more involved and almost part of the team and part almost training the horse a little bit, not picking out races, but just trying to develop a horse. And I think that's what you had certainly well at the beginning and the end, I guess. So your career kind of came full circle in that respect.
It really did, and I'm, you know, listen, I really didn't want to stop riding, and like I lamented a few times to my wife early on about, well, you know, I would have loved to have, you know, won a nice race, felt just that satisfaction, hopped off, gave the horse a pat, and that was, you know, that's the end of it. And she looked at me and laughed. She said, "You were never going to do that. You were going to ride until they made you stop," and that's what happened. So,
right.
And she's right.
Yeah, there's a fine line between, and I think I walked that fine line too. When I was riding, when I would get down about anything, life, who I was, what was happening about my career, I would actually look ahead and say, "Oh, but I'm riding to Ridley on Saturday, and if he wins, that'll pick me back up, and I'll feel good again." Now looking back, I don't have those kind of things. I almost wonder if that played into the imbalance of who we are. And I just wonder if that's something that when you're riding, you're always looking for the next win, and the win and the losses are kind of, it's almost like a ricochet between those two. And then you retire and you don't have that to try to balance yourself, although I think it's completely unbalanced, but you don't have that. Is that something that you've struggled with or thought about when you rode or now? I mean, is that something you kind of have to figure out other ways to remain balanced or get your balance back?
Well, I think that balance is elusive for everybody. I think that's one of the keys to life is finding a balance, you know, of doing the things you have to do, the things you like to do, you know, being well-rounded. And when I was a rider, I had absolutely no balance whatsoever in that respect. You know, I was blinkers on and you know, looking at life through a keyhole, basically, and not even really acknowledging or understanding that in that moment. I can look back on it now and see it. It wasn't an easy way to live, you know, between making weight and, you know, you know, if I was riding 9 the next day and had a workhorse in the morning, I was going to be in bed at 9, and even if I wasn't sleepy, lay there and try to will myself to sleep because I've got to get more sleep because I'm on 9. You know, when you have children, it certainly, you know, changes your perspective and you look at things differently. You know, I was a rider that, you know, through my career, I would purge. I would eat and have to go get rid of it because I just wasn't able to make weight. And then when you have kids, you don't come home and sit down and eat for, you know, half an hour, 40 minutes, and then go do what you have to do and then come out and be dad. I recognize that they don't care if I won 5 today or I got beat on 5 favorites or I've got to make weight or I'm tired. They're just happy dad's home. So I quit doing that at the house, at least. You know, I gained control of that, where if I did it, it was once a day, not 3 times a day, or, you know. And it was mostly because my kids brought me out of that, going, they don't, you know, I can't force my career onto their lives and make it, you know, more difficult to be a kid in my house. I mean, then I came to this realization, you can fail as a jockey, but you can't fail as a father. And you can't come back from that. You know, at least, you know, as a jockey, I've got, you know, other opportunities. I'll somewhere to work out. But honestly, my kids made me a better person because I was just so selfish and so self-centered about my career.
Wow. Well, you didn't fail as a jockey, and you haven't failed as a father either, so you've done well in both. One last question, and this is one I borrow from my favorite podcast, How I Built This. But when you look back at your success, how much of it was hard work, talent, and how much of it was luck? I mean, when you look back at your career?
I think the majority of it, you know, I think it's a confluence of all of those things, but the majority of it was hard work. I was not a natural rider. I was not built to be a jockey. I really had to force my body into, that role. And, you know, and it was great. I mean, I was lucky in the respect that I, hooked on with Steve DeMauro very young. To have him coming off of years with Wajima and Dearly Precious and winning the Eclipse Award, for him to open up his shed row and put me under contract gave me instant credibility in people's eyes. And then he really had a plan for me. Like everything, like I said, that I probably didn't understand so much when I was young, and I'd get, you know, upset about something, and why isn't he letting me ride yet, or why isn't this happening? He was thoughtful about it, and he basically mapped out my career and how it was going to go, and teaching me. And frankly, I grew up in his barn. He was, you know, like a surrogate father to me. So that was extremely lucky. And then I think anybody who has any success in any athletic endeavor has to have a certain inherent amount of natural ability. But I think, you know, you and I have spoken, and I was pretty depressed for a while about not being able to ride anymore, particularly when I felt physically better, that, you know, like, well, why can't I do this? I was going someplace with this. And, oh, see how many concussions I get?
I can match you, too. I can go one for one with you. Don't worry.
No, but basically, you know, looking back on it and knowing that I was able to get the most out of the ability that I had, that whatever gifts God gave me, I didn't leave anything out there. I put it all out there and did the very best I could with whatever God-given ability I had. And that's the only thing that was able to kind of get me out of that depressed feeling of, well, you know what? I couldn't have done more. Like if I had been a guy that kind of gave it a half effort and knew that I could have done better with my career, rode more winners or done something different, that I couldn't live with. That I think I would still be depressed over it. And I tell kids this, you know, young riders, I talk to them all the time. There is a day that it'll be your last ride. For every athlete, there's a baseball player, last at bat, football player, last play. Hopefully it's like Jerry Bailey, Chris McCarron, Pat Day, when you decide you've had enough. Majority of guys don't get to make that decision. You don't want to look back on it when it's over, because when it's over, it's over. That was your last ride that I could have done better, because there's not a do-over. And it's just important to make the most out of your abilities and be the best you can be.
No doubt. You did that better than anybody. We lost Steve DeMar last summer. If you could have one last conversation with him, what would you say to him?
Well, I'm so blessed that we had dinner the previous summer at Saratoga. And he turned to me during the dinner and said, I want you to know how proud I am of you. That he goes, you know, you were a tremendous rider, and I'm so happy you retired. I didn't want to see you get hurt anymore. But what you've been able to do since your career ended, he goes, I watch you, and I can't tell you how proud I am of you. And I can't say how much that meant to me, and that we had at least that opportunity to have a conversation about not me as the kid who came up in his barn and was a jockey, but the man that he helped shape.
That's Richie Migliori. Steve DeMauro and all of us are proud of you, and it was a joy to watch your career, and we're thankful you're still involved in the sport.
Thanks, John. Thanks for having me on.